and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, my own Mr. Watson, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
All right. Listen, folks, I'm going to just give you a fair warning on this. There may or may not be dumb crimes. This is a mystery. We don't know. Why, you say? Because I'm pre-recording the show a few weeks early, as I will be in Florida with my bio dad, who's getting his second COVID shot. And we don't know how it's going to affect him. He's a 75-year-old gentleman. We heard that second shot can knock you down. So I wanted to get the episodes in the can. And obviously, we can't read news from the future as much as we've tried. Tim and I have subscribed to every future website, but they just don't shoot us news from the future, which sucks, Tim. I feel like we're getting gypped by the internet.
No, it could happen, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. What we need is good AI software that can pull the future news for me, Tim.
No, you know what happens after that, Dave? Then they take over the world.
Yeah, you and your Cyberdyne Productions, man. They're not going to attack. But we've got a great guest that's going to be with us. If in fact, things are easier, I will record some Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals with Tim. We'll tack him on to the end of the show. If not, please understand it's only for this week because of family obligations and making sure that everybody's healthy and safe in my family. So I hope you understand that and can appreciate that. Let's get started today. Our guest, Lieutenant Rita Schuler, was supervisory special agent of the Forensic Photography Department of the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division for 24 and a half years. She interfaced with the Attorney General's Office, solicitors, and investigators, providing photographic evidence assistance in the prosecution of thousands of criminal cases. Her interest in photography started as a hobby at the age of 9 with a Kodak Brownie camera. Before her career as a forensic photographer, she worked in the medical field as a radiologic technologist for 12 years. Her interest in forensic science evolved when she x-rayed homicide victims to assist with criminal investigations. Ms. Schuler received her specialized law enforcement photography training at the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy in Columbia, South Carolina, and the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. She holds a special love for the South Carolina Lowcountry and enjoys walking, beaches, crabbing, fishing, and shark tooth hunting. She resides in Johns Island, South Carolina. The book is out and available. We have a link for it in today's program. Guide, The Lowcountry Murder of Gwendolyn Elaine Fogle, A Cold Case Solved. Welcome to the show, Lieutenant Rita Schuler. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your interest in my books.
Well, again, thank you very much for serving in law enforcement. Tim and I always tip our hats to those that have worked in law enforcement to try to provide justice for people. So thank you for your years of service.
Thank you. I really, really had a passion for my work.
Well, let's get into this. I want to know a little bit about you because I'm fascinated by what your position was and what exactly is a forensic photographer and what do you do? What is the importance of your job?
Well, as forensic photographer, I was supervisor of the forensic photography department, and in South Carolina, we have a state law enforcement division, which I will refer to as we go along as SLED. And that is a state-based agency, as the FBI is the national-based law enforcement agency. And at SLED, when I was there, we had a crime scene unit, and they would go out to the crime scenes pretty much and photograph the crime scenes, collect evidence, bring them back to the forensic lab. And if they took pictures back then and we had film back then, we didn't have any nice digital photography. So we had film and I had a photo lab there where they would bring me the film back from the crime scene. I would develop and process the film, print up the photographs from the crime scene, follow me my file, as well as give a copy back to the crime scene division for their files. So we actually had two files. And then if we were assisting a local agency, we would also send them a copy of the photograph. So we had like three copies of the crime scene photographs on file. And the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division was an assisting agency. we had to be invited in to help process the scene, and they would call our crime scene unit. But my major job was when they collected the evidence from the crime scene, they would bring it back to the lab to evaluate it further for fingerprints, shoe prints, whatnot. And they would bring the evidence over to me to photograph and document the actual physical evidence from the crime scene. Say it was a glass with a fingerprint on it, I would photograph the fingerprint. And we had to use special lighting in our photography lab there, which was a saving grace because you couldn't do that at the crime scene back then. So I had set up my lab from my teaching from the FBI and the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy. I actually had my lab set up pretty close to the FBI Academy lab. When I went up there, I was just so impressed. When I came back, I pretty much set up our lab like that. So my main duty was to photograph the evidence, and if they needed enhancement on fingerprints, shoe print, just any kind of enhancement they needed, then I would photograph it in the lab, and I would file the negatives and prints in my file in the photography lab. Also give a copy back to the crime scene, and they in turn would give a copy to the assisting agency that asked for our help. Sure.
Now, can I ask, Rita, when we're examining photographs for evidence in a crime, how much weight do photographs hold? Because, again, I know the eye and the human witness can be subjective because of the angle of incident, where they were watching from, what they were doing. How much weight does the photograph itself hold? Because if the photographer was at a weird angle or something, can that kind of distort or create false positives in the photographic element?
It could, but that's why we needed training, and we trained the photographers when they go out to the scene, you know, take it at a 90-degree angle so it won't be angled. And trust me, we had to do some fancy photography work back in the lab sometime when the locals would bring us in photography that they didn't take exactly right, but we could get close. We could get close. And the main thing about photographs now is that the photographs show exactly how the crime scene was when the assailant left it. That's why you start from the road, the signs, and go in to the house, and you take photographs of everything so that they will not be disturbed. This is a true depiction of the crime scene as the assailant left it. And the good thing about photographs is they can be kept forever. You can always go back and pull them out of the files, and photographs almost tell you a story if they are taken correctly. But they have to be taken correctly, and as any crime scene is processed, mm-hmm. if you go back years later, it's only as good as what was done in the beginning. I like to use that word, go back to the beginning. And you'll see that's pretty much how our case was solved here. But I always like to say, go back to the beginning. And even back then, you know, 2 or 3 years before cold cases got so popular, if they would get a suspect, then they could call us. We could go pull our file and the crime scene file and use their file. And those photographs tell us the story. And you can find things in a photograph sometimes that you don't even see with the naked eye. When I used to process film in the lab, what I could see on the negative when I printed it up, you could see more sometimes. And that's what we call enhancing. It's not manipulating.
Sure.
People in court say, oh, photographs can be manipulated. No. This was enhancing. This was enhancing, not manipulating. We were in a law enforcement environment then. We couldn't manipulate. We had to enhance.
Now, as a specialist, when you look at these photographs, I mean, obviously you're trained to look for all these different elements and things that maybe were overlooked during the initial investigation. May I ask you one rabbit hole question here, just that ties into our other program?
Shoot.
I know this sounds strange. We also do a paranormal radio show for the rest of the week. I've actually had some police photographers that have talked to us and have sent in pictures on crime scenes where they've captured something unusual, paranormal, that they can't make sense of. There's a very famous photograph, if our listeners want to look it up, it's called The Screaming Ghost, and it's a very tragic, sad story of this boy that was killed in a car accident, and the photographer took pictures of the entire scene, and you could see the young man slumped over in the front seat, but when they stepped out and they were taking pictures outside the car, there's an image of this boy standing there screaming. Have you ever seen any strange artifacts in photographs that don't seem natural?
I have not very many, but I have seen them, and there's usually an explanation for it. But don't get me wrong, I believe in chance encounters. I don't believe in coincidences at all. I believe in chance encounters, and as you'll see in my book as well, there was many chance encounters, and there was many twists, and they're most importantly what I call hand to God moments. It's almost like God holding his hand out and say, take this, go run with it.
Wow. And very cool.
And yes, I have seen that. And this is off record, but I had one case that they sent me where the image of the dead person showed up on the television screen before he was killed. And I think that was done. I really don't believe that was true to life, but it made us think. But I do believe in signs, and those hand to God moments, they're out there. Trust me.
Very cool. Well, I don't want to belabor that, but I'm always fascinated by that aspect and element. And I like the fact that you're like, hey, I've seen some weird stuff, but some of it can be explained. But it's those weird instances where they cannot that our show follows up on as well. Well, let's talk about the book, The Lowcountry Murder of Gwendolyn Elaine Fogle, A Cold Case Solved. How did you come to this story?
Okay. As I said, every case in South Carolina, if the local agencies, police agencies, or sheriff's department, any small department, and back then in 1978, if they needed assistance in processing crime scene, they would call in SLED, crime scene unit, and that was after the fact. We never got there while it was going on like they were. We were called in after the fact. So they would call headquarters and our crime scene would respond, and they would go to the scene and, as I said, process it, photograph it, work with the locals as well. And most of the time the locals would be taking pictures, and they would give the film to SLED crime scene to bring back. And I developed quite a bit of film for the local agencies so they wouldn't have to go out to independent labs. So when Elaine's case happened, they did not call SLED in. That was one time they did not call SLED in, but they did call the SLED Bloodhounds, and I'll get to that one in a little bit. They did not call SLED in, the crime scene unit. They processed the crime scene themselves with the assistant. This was the police department, and it was in the city. And they asked for the assistance of the sheriff's department. So for that reason, they did not call SLED in, because they figured they had enough expertise there to do that. And then they would bring SLED in when they needed processing of the evidence in the labs, the chemistry lab, and also the fingerprint department, which was a part of the crime scene at that time. And the way I got into this was, this happened on a Saturday evening, early Sunday morning, and the local agency, Walterboro, brought all the film and evidence of fingerprints that they had lifted. They brought all of that to SLED on that Monday morning. And that was when I got involved in this case, because crime scene got the evidence and the photographs that they had taken at Walterboro had taken. They entered the film into our logging procedures. And of course that film would come to the photography department. So that told me, okay, you develop this, you print them up, anything they requested, you do that. And when Elaine's case came through, I developed and printed as normal, and a strange sensitivity came over me. And there was a visual moment as I viewed those photographs from Elaine's case. Her jeans were missing. But strangely, both of her shoes were still on. And her shoes were Sperry topsider loafers.
Okay.
I wore Sperry topsider loafers. I still wear Sperry topsider loafers. And she had personal items in her home that I had in my home. Country things. Mm. I was born and raised in the country. She was born on just the edge of Orangeburg, South Carolina. And there was a butter churn, stone jugs, and even a hand-operated corn shovel. And one of my crime scene guys, he said, Rita, what the hell is a corn shovel? Well, I had to explain that. I said, it's an iron cylinder thing. If you ever know anything about the country, an iron cylinder thing with iron spikes in it, you put a dry air corn in there and turn the handle, it'll shell it for you. And he went, okay. He said, I would tend to say that not too many people would have that in their house. I said, nope, I've got my daddy's, the one that we used when I was a child. And that was kind of, you know, you have to laugh to keep from crying sometimes.
Right, right.
That was kind of interesting. But my biggest shock was when I viewed the metal fire poker around her neck, which was used to strangle her after this person literally beat her to a pulp. He actually took a fire poker that was usually by her door. We finally found that she kept it there for protection. Her dad had given it to her. And he actually wrapped that fire poker around her neck after he was finished with her.
Oh, but my God.
He beat her with it as well, because there were bruises on her that matched back to this fire poker. The handle of the fire poker was like the spring on the handle of the fire
right.
poker.
When let's take it back. Introduce us to Gwendolyn Elaine Fogel. Who was she? And maybe walk us through what you know of her last few days and her life leading up to this tragic moment.
Sure. Elaine was born in December, I think it was the 15th, 1951, in Orangeburg, South Carolina. And after graduating from Orangeburg Calhoun Technical Education Center in 1972, she moved from Orangeburg to Walterboro. So she had been in Walterboro approximately 6 years when she was killed. And she worked at the Culloden Regional Hospital as a laboratory assistant. She later left that hospital position, and she accepted a medical assistant position with a Dr. Joseph Flowers. And I just learned that Dr. Flowers is still practicing. He's 80 plus years old now, but he is still practicing. And Dr. Flowers, he described Elaine as a hardworking, diligent girl. She'd go out of her way to help people. And he told the interviews, he said, you know, I am just distraught over her murder. It's very difficult for me to accept. He said, I didn't know any finer person than Elaine. And then friends shared some personal feelings as well. So the land became a real part of the community. Soon after she moved here, and she made friends easily. She was a dedicated worker. She took children to baseball games and sang in the choir at St. Jude's Episcopal Church. And I thought this was sweet. She had a cute kind of shyness about her and had the biggest heart. We never heard her say anything unkind about anybody. She was starting to have a lot going for her and recently started taking night classes at a college in Charleston, South Carolina, to pursue her college degree. And she also completed some art courses. One of her dreams was to become an accomplished artist. And her sister told me after I met the family that Elaine was my best friend. She said she was a tomboy growing up and loved to ride her bike all over Orangeburg. She'd go to the Edisto Gardens all the time. She was in a lot of church clubs at our church, and she loved children. She worked at a nursery with our mom until she graduated from Orangeburg Regional Tech School. She loved doing all kinds of things with our mom and dad, grandmama, aunts, uncles, and cousins. And they were a very, very close family that I learned later on as well. And Elaine loved to draw and paint, and she started taking art courses, as a friend said. She painted pictures and gave them to her family for Christmas before she was killed. And that is Elaine Fogel.
So this was kind of a major surprise then. This wasn't somebody that was running in bad circles. This wasn't somebody that rubbed people wrong and was, might have enemies out there.
Not at all. Elaine was loved by everyone in Wolfsburg. She'd become a real part of that community. And as I said, she was from Orangeburg, South Carolina. And again, I was born and raised in Orangeburg County, South Carolina. So that, again, hit home with me. And it was almost to a point that I had an eerie feeling of a personal connection with Elaine from day one when the crime scene photos came in and that case came across my desk. That was actually one time that I would go home at night and I would actually think about it and get a little bit scared. I didn't do that very much, but I did it with Elaine's case because, looking at her picture too, and she and I almost, we looked alike. We dressed alike. She had a little rugger shirt too. Like we used to wear back then, a little striped rugger shirt. Of course, he had it pulled up around her neck. But just the simple things like that just gave a connection to me.
That has to be hard, just kind of as an aside, again, to be a forensic analyst, to look at these photographs and see the carnage of crime after crime after crime, and then to actually connect with somebody, a victim, because of surroundings and circumstance, to look into that part of their life. How do you separate yourself from that, Rita? How do you, or don't you? Does it always kind of haunt you?
Well, I've been asked that a lot of times. And I think another thing, too, is I had and still have such a passion for my work, and especially for the victims and their families, the innocent people that are left behind. I didn't have nightmares. I never had nightmares about any of my cases. And I think it was a God-given thing to me as well that I was able to, I don't think you can say separate, but I was able to combine it with, okay, I'm going to help them here now. And I'm not going to be scared. I'm not going to be shocked when I see anything because, even the shock can tell you something about the person who did this. I started this in my young years. I remember a crime scene, and that was in one of my first books. I was only 8 years old, and my mom and dad would let us know about anything bad happening around the neighborhood. They let us read it in the newspaper. They wanted us to know that these some bad stuff was happening out there, not to scare us. And I started that. I actually followed a murder, a very gruesome murder, when I was 8 years old. And the first day I went into SLED, they didn't show me the pictures of this case, and they said, "Rita, you're going to be working with things like this." And I went, "Wait a minute, I know that case. When I was 8 years old, that happened in Pamplico, South Carolina." And they went, "Oh my God, I guess you want to see the case file now." And I said, "I absolutely do." And that was the first story that I started with in my first book, Carolina Crimes. So I knew I was where I was supposed to be when I went in there that day and they showed me this case. And I don't know if they showed it to me to shock me or whatever, but they were shocked that I remembered the case when I was 8 years old. So I've had a curiosity about death and why people do things like they do all my life. Sure. But getting back to the original question.
I'm sorry to take you off on that tangent. I was just curious because I got to guess listeners like myself would be fascinated to hear that element of your life. But you were affected by this case. You said that do you believe that you were so affected because you felt kind of akin to this person and their lifestyle?
Yes, and the brutality of it as well. I just couldn't imagine somebody going in there and wrapping a damn fire poker around her neck, and he beat her to a pulp before probably he wrapped the poker around her neck. And he wanted to make sure, I guess, that he completed the job.
Well, let's talk about the day of her murder. What do we know about the actual murder? I mean, aside from the brutality of it, do you have a timeline of,
I do have a little bit of timeline. The attack happened on May 27th, 1978. And that Saturday evening, Elaine had babysat for some friends. And she left her friends after babysitting around 11 p.m. that evening, which would have her arriving home about 11:30 p.m. And Elaine's roommate and friend came home around 1:45 on that early a.m. Sunday morning and unlocked the front door. And there they discovered Elaine on the floor, covered in blood, unconscious, partially nude, and she was lying on the living room floor in front of the couch. They immediately left and went to the Walterboro Police Department, which was only a mile away. They could not tell if Elaine was alive or dead, but it appeared that she had been severely beaten and possibly sexually assaulted. She was laying on her back on top of the hook rug in front of the couch. One foot was partially up on the couch and one foot was on the floor. And I found this strange. Her jeans were off, but her shoes were still on. And she was nude from the waist down. Her bra and shirt had been pulled up around her neck, and her head and face were covered in blood beyond recognition. And there was that metal fire poker wrapped around her neck. There was also a blood trail on the floor right inside the doorway leading to her body, where it was located on the rug in front of the couch. And this indicated that she'd been dragged from the doorway to that area during the attack. And because the front door was locked when a roommate came home, the original investigators thought that the attacker might have already been inside the house when Elaine arrived home. When she unlocked the front door and stepped inside, he probably administered his first blow and then locked the door behind her to keep her from escaping. Elaine appeared to have been beaten with any weapons of opportunity that the killer could get his hands on, which included, and these were shown in the crime scene photos, a lamp, and there was a broken smiley face bank, a walking cane, and of course, that metal fire poker. And this happened in the living room. Mm-hmm. When you open that front door to the house, it went right straight into the living room. There were items in our home that were broken and thrown all around the room. And an end table was thrown over against the wall near the front door. And of course, blood was just everywhere.
So does this then, obviously, if they think there was some sexual contact, are they looking at this as a crime of passion, or are they looking at this as a crime of happenstance?
We think that it was a crime of happenstance, as you say, and we believe, as well as the original investigators, and when we look back over the case ourselves, that Elaine worked for Dr. Flowers, as I told you, and they considered that since drug activity, it was prevalent in many areas of the town then, that he may have broken into the house looking for drugs. And this reinforced the investigators' belief that the killer was inside the house. And he was probably in the process of a burglary when Elaine arrived home. And when she opened that door, the element of surprise hit him. And she stepped inside, and it enraged him that she interrupted what he was doing, and the burglary went wrong. He then started attacking her, and it turned into a sexually motivated attack and murder.
Taking it almost personally that she would interrupt what he was doing, that was his way of lashing out?
This is correct. And we later learn that he did not like a female talking back to him. He did not like a female treating him bad. He did not like that.
All right. This tragedy takes place. And again, what was around the time frame that this happened?
Okay. We figured it. She would probably have gotten home around 11. Let's see, around 11:30 p.m. And then between that time and when her roommates got home around 11:45 a.m. the Sunday morning, it happened between that time. So we do believe that he was in that house around 11:30 p.m. when she got home. And right. May have been in there before.
Okay. Who finds her? How long is she there before somebody uncovers this heinous sight?
Okay, that's when her roommate and roommate's friend came home at 1:45 on that Sunday morning, and they unlocked the front door, and they saw Elaine. They found Elaine, her roommate and her friend, when she was covered in blood on the living room floor. They found her around 1:45 a.m., and they instantly went to the Walterboro Police Department, which was only a mile away. They did not touch anything. They backed out of the door, Billy said, and went to the Walterboro Police Department, and they came to the crime scene promptly.
Now, I know that's got to be problematic to a degree, right? Because, again, as investigators, you want to keep an area as pristine as possible. How much interference did they create by coming home and finding her body like that? And then how hard does it get to say, well, I know you've got to eliminate roommates and loved ones right away, but how do you do that when they're the ones that find the body?
Well, in this particular case, they didn't touch anything. They walked in and they looked at Elaine and saw where they didn't know if she was alive or dead. They touched nothing. They backed out. Now, later on, when this was a small town, later on, there was some traffic in and out of that crime scene, and Dr. Flowers himself actually came over to the crime scene. So, yes, that can disturb a crime scene, and that's what I say. Get there first. Get those photographs done, and they will show exactly how the assailant left it. In this particular case, we didn't find too much that you know, the traffic in and out of there did not hinder the investigation. We never found where that hindered it. But, you know, at that time, too, the pathologist would actually go to the crime scene, and he would photograph the body, and he would do kind of a preliminary exam of the body itself. And in this case, Dr. Trefney, the pathologist, did go to the crime scene.
All right. The body's recovered. She's found like this. Who do we immediately begin to investigate? Obviously, like I said, roommates and close loved ones. Do they just run into a brick wall from the start, or does there seem to be a wide swath of possibilities that slowly just exhaust themselves?
Well, from day one, and this, I think this was a hindrance through the whole investigation. From day one, the investigators, the main investigators that were there, they focused on a suspect. And his name was Ronald Allen. He lived around the corner narrowly. He was big. He lifted weights. He had run in with the law enforcement. He had him a little rap sheet. And he was actually a backyard mechanic. So they figured, okay, here he is. And we had run-ins with him. He drinks liquor. He'd be strong enough to bend that fire poker around her neck. And they talked to him. They talked to his wife that night. And from that day on, they just thought Ronald Allen was the guy. They stayed focused and tunnel vision on him. And this were their original investigators, as well as one investigator that picked up this case later on. They stayed focused on Ronald Allen. And I think that kind of hindered them from trying to go forward with another suspect.
Well, it's got to be tough, right? I mean, as law enforcement, your job is to see kind of an overall view, to see these things and really kind of hone in on a suspect or two. And when you've got somebody that seems to fit the bill right there, that tunnel vision, I know a lot of us get frustrated and you're like, God, examine multiple levels. Why just focus on one? I've always been curious, and I don't know if you have any unique insight on this, but so, you know, if there's a bunch of us investigating this and I come down with this theory that it's, you know, Colonel Sanders in the, you know, drawing room with the lead pipe, why doesn't Dave Schrader, you know, follow that lead? And then Tim Dennis thinks it's Colonel Mustard in the basement with the rope, and he follows that light. Why do they just all kind of focus on one lead instead of four or five people kind of really focusing on alternate angles, so that way we don't lose that precious 48-hour window? We don't lose that precious time to examine a bigger scope possibility.
I don't know. It just happens that way. And sometimes it's easier to, okay, you're the one, you fit the bill, you're right here, you had the opportunity, you know, to just walk over there and do this. He lived just on the block next down from her. But in the interview with Ronald Allen and his wife told him, he was here with me all night. And if you look at this trailer, they lived in a very small trailer. Ronald Allen was a big man. And she said she slept on the outside of the bed, and he would have had to crawl over her to get out of that trailer. And he did not leave that trailer that night. But she didn't. And here's one thing that's important, too. She did tell them in the beginning of the investigation, the investigator who went over and pretty much, okay, you did it. And she says, you know, I remember the dogs coming down. You remember me telling you the sled bloodhounds were called out that night?
Right.
But I remember the dogs coming in. We heard the ruckus over there. I remember them coming in. She said, I got up and looked out of the window, and the dogs were headed and ended up at our water spigot, and there was a black guy at our water spigot. washing up. And I told, she told the investigator this. They never followed up on that. It was always Ron Allen did it. They never followed up on the black guy at the water spigot. And later on, when Gene and I got on, Corporal Johnson and I got on this, he talked to the wife again. And she said, yep. She said there was a black guy washing up at the water hose right there during the time. They're over there processing the scene. The black guy's over there washing up at the water hose. And I do believe that was the bad guy. I do believe he was the one that killed Elaine Fogle.
Okay.
But they never followed up on that. And you see, the bloodhounds took the scent over to where he was at that water spigot.
Ugh.
It's a speculation, but I, knowing how things work, I do believe that was him that night, that morning. It was early morning.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right. So they miss, they blow that lead. They blow that possibility. Yeah. Is there anything in the notes that say why, or, you know, it would seem that that would make sense, especially if the dogs led people there and somebody had seen somebody there.
Yeah, we don't know why. We don't know why. That was never reported. We never saw it in a case file. The only way we found this out was her telling us this once Corporal Johnson and I got on it. She was Corporal Johnson interviewed her, and she told that.
All right. Gosh. Now, this case, again, this takes place in the 1970s, correct?
1978, yes, sir.
Right. And how long before they've kind of exhausted all of their concepts of suspects?
Okay. Going back to Ronald Allen, the suspect, he got tired of them harassing him. He finally left town, which makes him look bad again. He stole a car and left town. Makes him look bad again, and he goes back to his family up in Tennessee. So they're still tunnel vision and focused on him. But after he leaves town, of course, the investigation, and we don't have too much documentation of anything that was going on at that time in the old files. And again, if Walter Burrow took care of it, and they were interviewing people, sometimes SLED did not get any reports of what they were doing unless they needed our assistance in the forensic lab. So we didn't have any idea of what all was going on then. And even when we got back on it and we tried to check files too, we didn't see much of anything except that they did take a few statements from the boyfriend and people that were arrested around the area, and they actually polygraphed a few, which ended up being nothing. And I still, to this day, they got a lot of fingerprints and palm prints from there, and we always heard that they sent the names up to SLED, to our fingerprint department, and they checked them all out, and none of them matched up. We never really found any reports to that. It was just more or less talk. But we never found any reports as to many fingerprint examinations being done and trying to compare them to the prints at the crime scene. So that confused us, too. But obviously, through the years, they didn't find the person that any of those fingerprints belonged to, if, in fact, they did check those prints out at SLED. That there wasn't much on fingerprints in the case file, except for the prints that I've, they lifted some good prints from the scene, which was filed in my file, and also crime scene had a copy. And Walter Burrow had some, but we had them all. When we were looking in their files, they didn't have everything that we had. So fingerprints never really was checked out. But let's see, in September of 1978, this will be And let's see, this happened in May, June, July, September. And in about 5 months, there was an article in the Walterboro newspaper, and it reported that nothing conclusive had come out of the evidence that was being processed by SLED or the medical university. But, of course, they told the public the case had not been put on the back burner. It was still worked on every day. And then the investigations continued. And it, we, like I said, we did see reports of potential suspects, and there were some statements made from different people, one being Elaine's boyfriend as well, and he was pretty much ruled out because they had broken up about 2 years before. Now, in March 1984, they did have some reports in there of two new suspects.
Really? Okay.
And these were actually reports that two inmates wanted to talk. You've heard that before.
Right, of course.
Two inmates wanted to talk. And those reports showed that they knew a lot about the crime details. And they dropped some names on the street. It could have been him. It could have been him. But the more they talked to him, the more it said that they wanted to look big, maybe, and possibly get reduced sentences, of course. And they just probably heard the talk on the street of what had happened, because everybody was talking about this in Walterboro. Everybody. And these guys may have known the guy, and, you know, sometimes they don't tell on him, but they dropped some names. They checked out all the names that they dropped, they say, the investigators back then, and nothing happened. But that was actually the only real suspects that they really considered a possibility. They kept all that on file in case they had to go back. And when Corporal Johnson got on it, he did go and talk to these guys again, and he knew they didn't do it, because they told a different story as to how they entered the house than we knew how the bad guy entered the house.
Yeah, so it's weird, right? After all those years, for somebody to come forward at that point to try to clear it, and still they didn't have the proper information.
That's correct, and that was 1984.
Right. All right, let's take it on then, as this story continues, and obviously a cold case. This is something that nagged at you. Are there many of the cases that you worked on that remained cold, that stuck in your craw, or was this special because of, again, that feel of your lives seemed very parallel with the things that you liked, the things that you decorated with, you know, the area? What more can you tell me about that?
This was my baby. I couldn't let this go. But then, of course, you know, we get busy with other cases, and we hear nothing from Walterboro, so we figure, okay, well, nothing's going on. And back then, cold cases weren't as popular as they are today. So, you know, we work on that. And I, again, assist the investigators. I'm not, quote, the investigator, but, yes, this case stuck with me. I had other cases that were unsolved as well, but none hit me like this one did. And I just couldn't let it go. I couldn't let it go. And let's see. Here's one thing I do remember. Let me go back a little bit, too.
Please.
The South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, they had what we call field residence agents in every county, every area of South Carolina. So like Walterboro, something happens, they would call that resident agent out to come to the scene, or maybe at the next day or whatever, because they were close. Where our headquarters was in Mid-State, the crime scene and the forensic lab. So we had agents around the area that could get there fast, and not per se they were crime scene investigators, but they were investigators that would go, and they were probably the ones that, okay, we better call a crime scene team here. And we did have an agent down in Walterboro at that time. And in 1985, he made a report in the case file that the case was closed. And that was 7 years after the murder. But if anything new came up, of course, it would be looked at again.
That's got to be frustrating, too, as somebody who feels connected to this case, to see the starts and stops and starts and stops. And then, you know, new tips or hints come in only to just kind of be devalued in time. How do we finally break this down and go from, you know, possibilities to finally closing a cold case after all these years?
Well, when the new tech, I want to go back too as well. We haven't spoken of the autopsy.
Yes.
You want to talk about the autopsy? Because that also has a good play in here. Let's see. The autopsy, and Dr. Trefney did this. He was at the scene. He was a pathologist. And the autopsy was done the following morning. And his cause of death was, of course, asphyxiation due to the presence of a metal fire poker around her neck. And because of the sexual assault, one important find with the autopsy results was that there was a large amount of semen collected from Elaine's body.
Okay.
And it was transferred to the resident SLED agent. As I said, SLED had resident agents in that area, and it was transferred to the resident SLED agent on Elaine's case to be submitted to the SLED chemistry lab. And that was a major point as well. We had a large amount of semen collected. And it was transferred. We had the transfer sheets from the pathologist to the resident SLED agent. He was to take them to the lab in Columbia, the state lab, to sign them in and have them evaluate the semen. Of course, back then you could only get a blood type or blood group. But it was transferred to him. And that was a part of the resident agent's duties as well, as would be to transport anything to Columbia to the lab that the local agencies needed.
A copious amount of DNA activity like that left behind. I mean, at that point, are they thinking this is something worth keeping? How did, you know, what was kind of the mindset, you know, because in 78, I don't even know if even the tingling of DNA collection was a thought.
It was only three letters of the alphabet, you know.
Right, right.
DNA. And no, but there was a possibility that they could get a blood type, which would eliminate some, you know, and possibly help with, okay, we'll keep them over here because they have the same blood type. And that was all it could be done with back then. But when the new technology started coming around in 1989, and let's see, that was about 11 years after the murder. Number one, we had a behavioral science unit that was set up at SLED. So we had him, the agent, David Caldwell, do a profile on the guy, and he did a profile on him, and it ended up, his profile would be, of course, 23 to 30 years of age, and he had to be muscular, and he probably had run-ins with the law, and he had a white male in the profile. Well, who does that look like? Ron Lallen.
Right.
He also said he probably left town. shortly after that happened, and he probably had some run-ins with the law. So that profile in 1989 kept them kind of focused again on Ronald Allen. And then that, too, was when DNA was in its early infancy, and you would have to have a DNA sample from the crime scene and a DNA sample from the bad guy in order to compare it to. Back then, they did not have databases, but that could have possibly been done. And also with fingerprints, you know, they did not have any fingerprint databases back then, but if they got a bad guy and his, you know, had his prints,
right,
and the prints from the crime scene, of course, they could compare them for a match. But none of that was done back then, because we didn't have a suspect.
All right. So when does this really start to break open? And was it something that you were a part of, or did it start to crack open and that's when you step back in to reexamine and look at this?
This actually started started looking at the case again in 2001. And that was because of, okay, DNA is going good now, so we're going to find those semen samples, and if we can find those semen samples, we might be able to find the killer. And because you could get, there was a lot, there was two big vials of semen collected from her. And that's what they thought. Okay, let's reevaluate all this evidence again, find biological evidence, and hopefully, you know, we can get that DNA from the semen and we'll have a profile of our killer. But
it's so fascinating to me that, you know, a 40-year-old case that DNA is still viable from something like semen, that there's still enough an information in that to nail somebody. That's remarkable.
And even now, it's even more remarkable. You don't even need a pinhead now. You know, back in 2001, you did have to have a fair amount, but as it grew through the years, my God, you can take pieces, just little inches right now. It's kind of like making it grow. And I'm not a DNA expert, but that's the way my DNA experts told me, you know, we can take a pinhead and we can just make it grow, so we'll have enough that we can do all kind of testing on. And so in 2001, they opened it back up again, and a resident SLED agent was assigned to the case down here. It was a different agent than the one with the semen, that the semen had been signed over to. It was a different agent. So he takes everything, he asks SLED to evaluate everything else. And Walter Burr did a wonderful job of preserving all the evidence. But the only thing missing was those semen samples. And it seems like everything else was there. But it was, the fingernail scrapings couldn't be found as well. But that's understandable too, because they would dry out.
Right. But it's weird that's, you know, semen that you get samples that survive that time, but then they lose other samples. To me, that's just so strange. Why aren't they all kept together? And I know this isn't necessarily something you can answer, but it's always so bizarre to me.
Well, we learned later that those semen samples never made it to SLED.
Ah, gotcha.
They never made it to SLED. And if they did, they weren't signed in like normally. And that's another whole story in itself. And I do bring that in the book. But before going ahead with that, let's go ahead about the new investigation.
Please. They
started in 2001. And at that time, when they started this new investigation, I'm retired now. I retired in October of 2001. But they started this investigation again because they want to reevaluate all the evidence to try and find DNA, because that's the big thing now. Fingerprints still weren't mentioned. It was the DNA they were looking for, and they knew the semen samples were there because it was in the autopsy report big time, and we'd talk to the, they'd talk to the pathologist, and I mean, his recording was meticulous. He had it 1, 2, 3. I mean, he didn't miss anything. So they reopened it in hopes that the DNA samples from the autopsy would give a full DNA profile of a killer. The samples could not be found in the case files or any record of them being submitted to the SLED chemistry lab in 1978. And the case was put back on the shelf again, unsolved. But one thing that came out of this, one plus that came out of this, was that they were able to locate Ronald Allen, the number one suspect. They were able to locate him. And they found him in Tennessee, but by God, by the time they got there, he had passed away. And they're going, oh, we wanted to get a DNA profile. I mean, we wanted to get, you know, blood from him so we could get a profile for him in case we find the semen samples or any other DNA. And here's one of those hand to God moments. The pathologist who had done his autopsy saved 2 vials of blood from Ronald Allen because he died under suspicious circumstances of whether it was an overdose. They feel it was an overdose, so he had to do the drug testing. And they allowed the South Carolina law enforcement agent that went up there to have a vial of his blood. And they brought it back to SLED and did a complete profile on Ronald Allen. So they now have Ronald Allen's complete profile. But we have no DNA from the crime scene to
match it to, right?
So we don't have a person. We don't have a person. But it's on file. It is on file. So we do have that. As I said, it was put back on the case unsolved. And that's when I started writing. I decided I was going to write books on cases I had worked on at SLED. And in my third book, Elaine's case is still, you know, on my mind. I'm still persistent trying to find out anything about it. They, in fact, called me back when they opened that case up in 2001 to see if I could enhance some photographs that they were looking at as a shoe print on Elaine's stomach in blood. It looked like a bloody shoe print on her stomach. And we were able to enhance it a little bit, but they didn't have shoes from anybody or they didn't have a suspect to try and match a shoe back to that print. They did get some of Ron Allen's shoes too, but I mean, that had been how many years? So none of that matched back up. And as I said, they had nothing to work with again. So it was unsolved. But when I started writing my books, I wrote 2 books. And then in 2006, I decided to write some stories of, as I was telling you before, of my small town, my small area that I remembered as a child. And I wanted to also include Elaine's unsolved murder at the end of that book, not mainly to bring it back to the public's eye, Walterboro's eye, and most of all, investigators' eye. Because I kind of got to be a busybody along in here, and I'd call Walterboro, and they'd tell me, hey, we got this, and we'll let you know if you can help us. But I snooped around and got some information that I could put in the book that was public information. And then I decided to try and find Elaine's family, and that's when Elaine's family came into my life. And it was around June of 2007 when her family came into my life.
They had to be kind of shocked and excited to know somebody was still beating that drum and carrying that torch for the death.
And you could have written my books. Yes. What I did, I was able to find her sister. And I wrote her a letter. I wanted to write her a letter first. And I wrote her a letter, and I told her that I was wanting to write Elaine's story. And she was, at first, I didn't hear back from her for a couple weeks. And I went, oh, God. I said, you know, maybe they just don't want to talk about this anymore. They don't want to bring it up again. Or worse yet, she may have passed away. And she was the only member of the family that I could find. She had an interesting name, Aeolian, so it wasn't too hard to find, along with some help with one of my guys that at Slade that helped me find her. And I wrote her a letter, and she was very humble when she did write back. She said she'd had some medical problems, and that was the reason she hadn't written back. But she was humbled, and she had talked to her family. And she said, honestly, Miss Rita, she said, we all thought Elaine had been forgotten. And I said, maybe by some, but not by all. And I told her my history of how it so touched me and how I just felt so connected to Elaine. And they had tried all through the years, too, to be informed of the status of the case. And actually, some of the family members offered to assist, and they got some information to Walterboro, but there was still no looking getting it solved. And so I went to meet Aeolian, and the first time I walked into the door, she had a strange look on her face, and I went, oh, Jesus, what is this? And I kind of stood back, and she said, oh, my God, she said, you look like Elaine. Y'all could be sisters.
Wow.
And that just connected me again. And, you know, the more I looked at Elaine's picture, yes, we could have been sisters. I mean, we did favor.
Right.
So I stayed connected with the family, and I tried to help them through it. But again, being retired, I was now not certified as a police officer. But I was still I still snooped around a lot. And I told them I could do, you know, I'll try and do anything that I could to help. And one person that I did talk to was a solicitor down in Walterboro. And he and I were on a personal basis, as well as me helping him on professionally, you know, if they needed assistance with photography when they were making a case. We actually drank a little bit of beer together. And he was that's how I knew him, through a family member too. He was married to a friend of mine. And I told him about Elaine's case, and I said, man, you know, with all this DNA and everything now, I said, I'm not certified law enforcement now, but what could we do can you help me to get this moving again? Well, he got to work, and he got his investigator to go over to the Walterboro Police Department, and he called me back. He said, Rita, he said, they have got a room full of evidence over there. And he said, whatever you have to do, get Sled back on this thing. He said, I'm going to send you some reports and some information on what I think you need to give them so they can pursue looking into it again. And one was that autopsy report. And he said, there was a lot of semen collected there. And it was signed in. So if you can find it, you'll get a DNA profile. And this was around 2000, and I guess it was around 2007, 2008. And so I did. I called Sled, but they didn't seem too interested. And then here's another hand to God moment of mine. I was looking around on my computer one day on Facebook, and I saw where Sled had opened a cold case unit. And this is in 2009. I went, okay, good. And Elaine's case was number one on the list, if anybody knew anything, to call. So, of course, I called, and it happened that everybody in the cold case unit I had worked with, so they welcomed me well, told me to bring all my information.
Very nice.
Told me to bring all my information over there, and I did. I took everything the solicitor had given me, and I took it over. And when I was meeting with them, one of the girls in there, I saw, boy, she was really into this. And I said, you know what? I think she's going to work on this thing. And, of course, they couldn't tell me anything because I'm not certified. So I wasn't sure. A while passed, and I wasn't sure that, you know, they were doing anything because God would been kind of disappointed so in the past. But another strange encounter, I went out one day and I went to the grocery store, and this cold case agent, Natalie, was in the grocery store, and she yelled at me. She said, Rita, we were going through the checkout line. She says, you know what? She said, I really got interested in Elaine's case. We've gone down and we brought back the evidence, and we're having it processed now with new procedures, new technology. And she said, I think we've found something we can use. She couldn't tell me.
Exciting, right.
Couldn't tell me. But, my first inkling was, oh, God, at least she's working on it. And my first thought, what was it? Maybe they found the semen samples. So, okay, time passed a little bit again, and I didn't hear anything. But I knew that they had done some work on it. And it was, didn't hear anything, gosh, until it was May 27th, 2015. This was the 37th anniversary of Elaine's murder. Her sister calls me and she said, Rita, she said, you know, I was sitting here today. I always read the story in your book of the case unsolved every year on the anniversary date that Elaine was killed. And she said, today I just felt, okay, I could hear Elaine and I felt like it was time to check with Walterboro again. I could hear Elaine saying, don't give up on me, sis. And I went, well, I guess you're going to have to call Walterboro, I said, because I hadn't heard a doggone thing from them. They pretty much told me to butt out sometime when I call them. She says, that's what we're going to do. And she now has an adopted daughter, and her daughter was very good with helping her do this. So they call Walterboro, and it so happened that Walterboro tells them, you know what? We have a new investigator here now, Detective Corporal Gene Johnson, and he is looking at Elaine's case right now. And they went, oh, my God. So they called me right back, and they said, Miss Rita, you better sit down because you ain't going to believe this. And that's when they told me that the investigator was looking at her case, and they had told Corporal Johnson to please contact Rita Shula. She's been with us through the years. She worked on it sled. He says, you know what? He said, my wife brought me home Elaine's story out of her book, the unsolved story out of her book that one of her co-workers gave to me. And he said, I read it all through. And he said, I was so impressed and even more excited when I saw she had worked on this case all through the years. And she worked on it from the beginning at SLED. That was another hand of God moment right there. And so he called me, and he asked me to assist him with the investigation. And that's when that wonderful man came into my life. Now we had full permission from the police chief for me to touch the evidence, look at the evidence, look at all the case files. Even though I'm retired, I'll do it as a retired law enforcement agent with SLED per mission of Walterboro Police Chief. So I was able to do that. And that's when we got together. We put our heads together, and again, we went back to the beginning. We had to really, there was a lot of files there, but we had to put it in order. And we saw everything that we could, that we might could use, and we were both just concentrating on finding those semen samples. I called SLED, and I told them how we used to sign in evidence and log in books and All they had to do was go get those old logging books to see if it was even signed in. And if it wasn't signed in, we could quit chasing our tails. Well, the people I talked to didn't have a clue of the logging books I was talking about, but I told them they were in archives. I said, I know the lady that took them down there. But for some reason, that never got done. But while we were looking through some of the files, we came across a report that it was a report from the cold case investigation that SLED had done in 2009.
Okay.
And it reported that they had reexamined the panties that were found at the crime scene on the couch in the living room where Elaine was killed. And they had found a mixed DNA profile in blood, not semen, in blood.
Okay.
And it was a male and female. The male being Elaine's. I mean, the female being Elaine's, the male is unknown. And the DNA profile, male DNA profile from the panties was entered into the DNA CODIS database in 2010. But no matches to a suspect had been returned. And I went, holy crap, this is what Natalie Croswell was trying to tell me in the grocery store that day.
That was the aha. So you finally have got that. That watching that final piece snap into place had to be such a...
That was the first piece. Yep, that was the first piece. And, of course, we got all of Natalie's reports after that from her case file. I actually called her and she said, yeah, she said the regional agent down there in Walterboro has them. So we got all of her reports and all of what she had done and then handed it over to the DNA analysts and all of their reports. And, but the case had gone back on the shelf again unsolved because they didn't have a person, but they did have the DNA in CODIS. And the only thing about mixed DNA, it's weaker than a full profile, and sometimes it will not hit like a full profile would. And they didn't get a hit from that. But one thing it did reflect, the report reflected too, that they did go back to the first suspect, Ronald Allen. We have his profile on file at SLED now. And they tested it against the mixed DNA found from blood on the panties, and it wasn't a match. So Ronald Allen is not a suspect anymore.
But finally, you're able to release the man that you know. Well, not release, but I mean, you're able to release him as a suspect that you've known the whole time was not your guy.
But Gene and I decided too. We said, you know, they've been focused on him so long, internal vision on him so long that they've been looking for the wrong man. And so we had to get back to the beginning again and go through all those names and suspects or whatever, which it wasn't that many. And,
right.
And we couldn't come up with anything. But we had a lot of twists and turns in between then. And then we finally got to a point, oh, my God, Rita, what do we do? And I'm begging SLED to please let me come up there and see if we can find if the semen was still signed, that was even signed in, you know. Maybe we can look back 10 cases above, 10 cases below. Maybe it's in the wrong case file or whatever, because, Lord, how many negatives was misfiled like that in my photography lab? But for some reason, that never happened. So one morning, I'm walking through my house here, and Gene and I had talked that night, and I said, okay, we got to go back to the beginning again. And one morning I was walking through my house. I did a lot of my work from home. And I said, okay, I'm going back to the beginning. This case came across my desk back in 1978. I developed and printed the photographs and fingerprints. And Jesus, a light bulb went on in my head. And I went, we've been so concentrated on DNA and finding something with DNA, we have not checked the fingerprints in my photo file. And I knew those old photo files were still there. That's one thing I asked them to do when I left. I said,
very cool.
Do not put these on microfilm or anything. I said, if you've got room to keep these negatives and keep these files, keep them, because they're going to solve cold cases one day. And by God, I picked up the phone and called my good buddy at SLED, Tom Darnell. And he and I worked together. Oh, God, I loved him to death. We worked together for, gosh, almost 15 years, I think. And he asked me, I told him about Elaine's case. He said, I remember you talking about that case forever, Rita. He said, what can I do to help you? And I told him that we were looking at it again. I said, please go over to my photo file. And I'm pretty sure those files are over there. And he said, yeah. He said, your old photo files are still there. And I said, look in there, see if you have any prints, negatives, or anything you can use to put in the APHIS and see if we can get a hit. Within an hour, he calls me back, and they had a hit on a palm print.
Wow.
And it was James Willie Butterfield, a 56-year-old black male. And within an hour, they had a hit on two fingerprints, James Willie Butterfield, which we think came off of the window that he broke into to get into the house. And those were lifted from the window. The palm print was lifted from that end table that was thrown over to the side next to the door in the crime scene photos. So we now have a name to work with.
Right.
That puts Willie Butterfield in Elaine's house at some point, but it doesn't put him raping and killing her. So Detective Johnson, he's been over there with the Sheriff's Department for quite a few years. He knew Willie Butterfield. He had arrested Willie Butterfield back in 2010 for a similar type case, beating an elderly lady almost to the point of death. And they found him that way after he beat her. Her blood ended up in his mustache and his beard, and they took that blood, and it was her blood, and that's how they knew Willie Butterfield had done that in his fingerprints, and he admitted to it, and he was put in jail. Willie Butterfield was put in jail how many times over the years? We learned that, and back out, put in jail, back out, put in jail, back out. So, you know, he was just slapped on the hand and put back out again. But they never thought to relate Willie Butterfield all through those years to Elaine's case. And we don't know why.
Unbelievable. But you did it. And evidence that you had insisted they keep a certain way is what helped crack and finally give answers. That is remarkable.
That gave us the name. Well, we found Willie Butterfield, and here's the sad part about it. Gene found him. He is in a mental institution. He is deemed incompetent to stand trial for anything he's doing. So,
but the answer is there. Yes. It doesn't go unanswered. It goes. You can officially close this case file. And although he may not have gone through trial, there's no reason for his bloody palm prints or handprints or fingerprints to be in that house unless he was there as a perpetrator.
Yeah, and here's the clicker too. Gene went and got his DNA. When he interviewed him at the mental institute, he got his DNA, but of course when he got that DNA, he took it straight to SLED, and yes, it did match. But then the solicitor says, if it ever goes to trial, we can't use this. And this is correct. They got it when he was deemed incompetent, yet he did sign his paperwork agreeing to all of this. And so we had to find another way to get that DNA. We had to see if maybe his DNA may have been put into the system with some of these cases that he'd done here back through the years. And again, here's another thing too. When they interviewed Willie Butterfield at the mental institution, Gene asked him, had he ever Benny and Elaine Fogle's house. He showed him pictures. He showed her pictures. And he showed him the house. He said, I don't know that house. I ain't never been there. Well, of course, he lied because his palm prints and fingerprints were in the house. And they told him that.
And he said, that lie makes a great admission as well, then, that there is a story to be told in that.
Absolutely. So anyway, when the solicitor told us that, then we had found another report of him being arrested in 2012 for assisting some lady carrying human remains around in the car, somebody she'd killed. He was helping her discard those human remains, and he was arrested at that time in 2012. Sled arrested him along with Walterboro, and that's when his DNA got into CODIS. And that's when his palm print got into CODIS. That's when his fingerprints got into CODIS. They had never been, into APHIS. They had never been admitted on any of the other cases he had up until 2012. But 2012, his DNA got into CODIS. 2012, his fingerprints and palm prints got into CODIS. And the reason, again, that even though his DNA got in 2012, it did not hit on that mixed DNA, again, because it was too weak, and it didn't kick out the full profile. This is from the experts at Slade.
Right. But do they believe now that in reviewing this that he does match with that DNA?
Correct, because the DNA that went in 2012 into CODIS is a full DNA. This is the buccal swab or the blood, his sample that he gave. It is his full DNA. And they have that on file at SLED. So they had to redo the analysis of the mixed DNA on the panties in the blood to the full DNA of Willie Butterfield, and it matched up. There was enough there to match it up. So it was checked 2 and 3 times over, palm prints, fingerprints, DNA, so it was 100% Willie Butterfield.
Well, that's incredible, incredible, Rita. Thank you for sticking to a case like this. I've got to guess that closure for her family had to be remarkable.
You know, I don't like the word closure. In my years of law enforcement, I'm just not fond of that word, but yes, it gives the family peace. We finally got him, and it gave the family peace knowing that we got him. And also, it gave, again, I believe in this, it gave Elaine peace. She can rest now. We finally got him.
That's fantastic. The book is out and available. There's a link for that book on today's program guide. As you saw, we got a big chunk of the information, but this book has a lot more details, a lot more information on how this case was cracked and how things lined up. So make sure you get the book, rate and review the book, and put it out there. So thank you so much for coming on and being a part of the show with us today, Rita.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much, too. And thank you for remembering Elaine.
You've got it. And I'm so thankful for her family that they've got answers and that part of their story can finally be written. Well, folks, again, we're at the point where it's the end of the show. Normally we would throw to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. Your guess is as good as mine if they come up next. It's all going to depend on my availability. If they're there, let's go to them right now, Tim. If not, thank you all for tuning in and being a part of our program. We'll be back again next week where you will find True Crime Tuesday and Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals.